But I thought you wanted to be cured.
That's what I thought too, Doc. But there ain't no cure for who you are.
Then you must live forever in the prison of your mutant powers.
I am my powers, and the good they can do for my friends and for the whole world. I reckon maybe I can live with that after all. Thanks anyway, Doc.
Yo, welcome to My Summer Lair. I'm your host, Sammy. My mutant abilities, I can nap anywhere, anytime, Yunnan. It's the return of Saturday morning cartoons. Well, on Wednesdays. Wednesday morning cartoons. It's not quite the same ring. Still, feel free to yam sugary cereal as you watch. I ate Fruit Loops. There was no treat at the bottom of the box, which is great because, you know, you always have to dig in the box and you get your elbow all dirty and, like, it's a mess. I'm talking about X-Men 97. Here's your previously on X-Men bit. I can't do the voice. Rogue, one of the X-Men mutants, is born with the ability to absorb the memories, powers, and physical traits of anyone she touches, which means she can't touch people. For Rogue, it creates a strange isolation and a love-hate relationship with her superpowers and who she is and who she is becoming. Rogue is one of the many mutants featured on Marvel's X-Men, the animated series, which broadcast 76 episodes starting October 31st, 1992, Halloween 1992. Rogue was voiced by Lenore Zann, and she'll continue to voice Rogue in this X-Men revival. Yes, because it's a cartoon, X-Men 97 picks up right where the original TV show finished on September 20, 1997, which means, sadly, Professor X is still dead. Lenore infused Rogue with a sorrowful loneliness while also being Southern and so, so sassy. Oh, you better believe my ears went all red when she called me sugar. In this conversation with Lenore, we trace her journey from Australia, coming to Canada, starring in Canadian classics like Happy Birthday to Me, yo, so happy I got that one in there, to going to York University where she studied drama and political science, eventually employing those poli-sci courses when she became an MP as part of Justin Trudeau's Canadian Parliament. I know, I get it. We're going to talk about X-Men cartoons and being a member of Parliament. That's how this chapter of My Summer Lair is going to go. X-Men 97 is currently streaming on Disney Plus, so you can set the VCR for that. Here we go with my gifted conversation with Lenore talking about Rogue back in action in X-Men 97. You get it? Gifted X-Men. Stephanie, save me!
Sound. The Final Frontier. My Summer Lair is an enterprise, a pop culture voyage with a continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new creators and celebrate established producers, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. And now here is your host, Sammy Yunnan.
You had that really great Rogue jacket too. The little X in the corner there.
I know. That's from the Uncanny Experience. That's a thing that is happening in Minneapolis on an annual basis now, where people can go into this Xavier school for the weekend and be students. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. So I went last, yeah. and they gave me a jacket, but you can order them from that, from the Uncanny Experience.
That's really cool. Did you like the Xavier's Lounge at the Toronto Comic Con? They had a lot of like beanbag chairs and like old school couches.
It was so much fun. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Those beanbag chairs were deadly, though, like trying to get up off of them.
Yeah.
I think the rule is generally once you've graduated university, that's it for beanbag chairs.
Like, no more beanbags.
Yeah, the center of gravity is just too much to overcome.
Right.
But this was your first con in Toronto. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was the first time we'd been invited to a Canadian con. Mm-hmm. We've been doing a lot of different American ones. But this was the first time we'd been actually invited to Toronto or to Canada. So we were really glad to be there.
And this is fitting because the show originally, like, you guys recorded the voices in Toronto.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you all initially in the same room at the same time when the show started?
Yeah, that's how we began. When we first started recording, we'd all be in the same recording booth, a big one. And they'd put a circle of microphones around and we would all speak into it and watching each other and listening to each other's lines, oftentimes trying to make each other corpse break up, you know, and laugh. And it was a really great bonding experience in those early days of the show. And we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it shows, because at Toronto Comic Con, the friendships and the way that you guys were talking, it was almost more like you were like a Star Trek cast. There's a deeper connection, whereas like, I'm sure now you are recording like just by yourself in a studio, right? So you don't have all the microphones set up. But you could see that those initial bonds, like you guys were a team as much as the X-Men were a team.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it was nice having the premiere in LA because we got to meet some of the newcomers to the show. And I had met three of them previously already, but it was really nice to be able to put, you know, faces to the names and be able to talk to people. Mm-hmm. It was interesting too, because when I met Holly Chow, who's now playing Jubilee, she cried when she met me. I mean, she just said, "Oh my God, Lenore, it's like we used to play X-Men in the playground at my school." She said, "When I was 8 years old, we used to play, and I always wanted to be Rogue." Mm-hmm. She said, "You know, I like Jubilee. I love Jubilee, but I always wanted to be Rogue." And she got really teary-eyed, you know, and she said it was us that made her decide that she wanted to be an actor. And the guy that plays Remy LeBeau, AJ LoCascio, he said the same thing. He said it was our show that made him want to become an actor.
That's amazing. So then it is kind of like when I said you guys are like that Star Trek cast, it is that same kind of legacy and that kind of inspiring, like the viewers, right? Where now the viewers now are starting to transition over and become like professionals and join the show. That's like, that's an amazing legacy when you have that transition where like, I want to grow up and be like what she does.
Exactly. And you know, it's funny because here's an interesting little serendipitous thing as well. When I was 12, I went over to the Prince Edward Island, to the Charlottetown Festival with my mom and dad to see Anne of Green Gables and their show that year. And it was the rock version of Hamlet, which was called Kronborg 1492 or something like that. It was called Kronborg. And Cliff Jones had written this musical, this rock opera of Hamlet. And it was that made me want to become an actor. And Cal Dodd was in that show.
Oh, okay. Wolverine.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, 5 years later than that, well, yeah, 7 years later, I was playing Marilyn Monroe in a rock opera on the life of Marilyn Monroe that Cliff Jones, the same author, had written. And then, you know, another 10 years after that, here I was working with Cal on X-Men. So, you know, it's interesting how those little seeds that fall into our minds can come to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, one of the nicknames for Hollywood is Tinseltown, and it's town because it's such a small industry. It feels very big, but you have those connections, right?
Where it's true.
You start to see some of the same faces or start to make those same connections. So
yeah.
I like that intimacy.
I do too. And you know, and also I love the fact that the Canadian theater crowd, that the Canadian theater industry is also very much involved, because the American producers of X-Men, the animated series in the 90s, had already tried out some voice actors. It wasn't successful and they weren't really happy with the results. So they said, well, what about if we go for theater actors who have sort of more gravitas, more like experience at playing real characters in a real way. And the scripts are somewhat Shakespearean, almost like Greek tragedies, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted that kind of oomph, that kind of gravitas. So they came to Toronto and they asked agents to send them their best theater actors as well. And so that's how many of us also got cast. So people like the guy that played Magnus, you know, David Hemblin, who is a fabulous theater actor. Mm-hmm. Many of them had a great, great theater resume. Cedric Smith, who played Professor X. And all of us younger ones, we had also done theater, but were also in film and television at the time.
I want to unpack that thread because that's an interesting insight. we touched upon, like, you guys were recording in Toronto. And I want to know, like, the X-Men in the cartoon and in the comics, the X-Men have always been outsiders. And I want to know, like, did working and recording in Toronto, especially in the mid-90s, did that contribute to that feeling of being outsiders and feeling different? And, you know, because by the time, like, the X-Men wrapped, the Raptors had just barely started.
It's interesting, you know. I mean, we were there at a time when theater was really happening in Toronto. I had just done a show called Unidentified Human Remains and the True Nature of Love with Brent Carver and a number of other incredible Toronto actors. And I had actually done that show for about 2 years in Toronto. Then I went to Chicago with the show, then New York off Broadway at the Orpheum Theater. And then I'd come back. And that was when I got X-Men. So there was a lot going on in Toronto. It was really blowing up at the time. It was a lot of excitement that we were doing a lot of film and television. CBC was really on a roll. Many of us were doing radio dramas and doing, you know, guest starring on different shows for CBC. It was a really incredible time. And I think most of us were on a roll in our careers one way or another. And so when we banded together, we weren't all like best friends who had known each other through the business, but we got to know each other and we really did form a great bond. And we would do a session and then go to a little bar that was upstairs on the street in the sun and sit and have a couple of beers and chat with each other and really continue the friendship there. And when the show finally ended, it was sad. It was like, oh, it's like we'd been in a TV series, you know, like as a cat series for 5 years. And then it was like, okay, well, now it's over. So we had a big rap party and I think it lasted 2 days. And
that's a good party.
Yeah, we ended up in Cal's pool at his house, which he still remembers this day.
And not just theater. I also want to acknowledge or just take a moment to acknowledge you were in Happy Birthday to Me.
Yeah. I did a lot of horror films during the 80s.
But that's a Canadian classic, Happy Birthday to Me. And I think I think you survived this one too, didn't you?
I did, yes, yes. Actually, there's a number of them that I survived and a number of them that I did not. But they called me the Canadian Scream Queen for a while there because I was doing so many of these horror films. Mm-hmm. But it gave me a chance to really practice my scream. So that when X-Men came along, I was ready.
Would you prefer?
Talk about my screams.
Would you prefer surviving at the end of the horror movie or getting killed? Because I would assume sometimes getting killed is fun, though, right?
Yeah, that's true. I like the survival, though. I like the message it sends.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So this is a good way. This is a good segue into Rogue, right? As we kind of circle back to Rogue. So you've touched upon it, but can you expand a little bit more? Like, how did some of your live acting in the theater that you're talking about, how did that influence or impact or shape your, like, voice acting for Rogue?
Well, because I had a theater background, you know, and I'd started quite young at the age of 15 and became professional at 17 and then got my first leading role, starring role as Marilyn Monroe by the age of 19 in this rock opera on the life of Marilyn that was called Hey Marilyn. I was used to doing my homework when it came to really delving into the character, figuring out why she is the way she is and what, you know, what made her that way. And so with Rogue, I was able to take what was written and what was given to me as her history and try to incorporate it into my voice so that you did hear a lot of her pain, her loneliness, as well as her sense of humor and her self-deprecation and her unwillingness to take fools lightly.
Sassiness.
Right, exactly. She's sassy for sure. So it was great to be able to utilize that and create a character that people could relate to.
Do we have to give any credit as well for that background that you're talking about to your grandmother's grandfather clock?
Ah, yes, there you go. That's a nice one. You want me to tell that story?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Because I think it contributes, doesn't it, to how you...
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure, how I ended up being an actor. Yeah. So when I was little, one of the first games I used to play was an imaginary game with my grandmother, who was very patient. And I would ask her to sit on a chair, and she had this big old grandfather clock in her house. And I would go behind the grandfather clock, and every time I came out from around it, I was a different person. And she had to guess who I was. Mm-hmm. So it could be a famous movie star, or it could be somebody in the family, or it could be an animal. It could be anything. And she, much to my great delight, she was such a wonderful first audience for me. You know, and I think, yeah, that is like a type of, that is acting. That's becoming a character. Mm-hmm. So early when I was showing signs of that kind of proclivity to try and portray other people.
Yeah.
You know, also my grandmother, I found out years later, was also in the arts herself. She was a chorus girl in the 1920s. Ooh. In music in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And in Newcastle, where she lived. And she had a beautiful singing voice, and she played piano. And she and her boyfriend used to perform at the halftime of the cinema when they would play movies. Back in those days, with reel-to-reel film, they would have to have a halftime when they would change the reels of film. Mm-hmm. And so they would hire entertainers to entertain the audience of the movie theater while they were changing the reel of film. And so my grandmother and her boyfriend were the singers and performers, played piano and sang duets during that time. So I think, okay, I do come by it quite honestly, mm-hmm. this talent and this desire to perform.
And I would assume too that means that grandmother knows how to like encourage you as well. So as you're coming out from behind the clock and you're like these characters, she kind of knows, yes, more than just encouraging children. Like she kind of knows how to encourage that creative spirit.
Exactly. And she always said to me, you know, Lenore, go out and set the world on fire. Just go out and do it. Don't let anything stop you. And that really did help set the wheels in motion for my going out and trying to set the world on fire, not literally, but figuratively.
Yeah, which again brings us back to Rogue, because like, yeah, what were your first impressions of Rogue when this character came to you?
Well, I saw the drawing, mm-hmm, of Rogue when I did the audition, the callback, and she was standing there, you know, with poise and grace, with one hand on her hip, and a real sassy attitude, as we've discussed. And I was told she has we're looking for a woman with a deep, husky, sexy voice who can do a Southern accent. And my agent went, well, Lenore, that's you. Like, there's nobody else in town that quite fits that bill. And so I went in and I took a look at the character drawing, and I thought, yeah, I can do that. And then I went into the booth and I read the little monologue that they had for me, which was, I remember to this day, my daddy liked to kill himself when he found out I was a mutant. I remember, had me a boyfriend when I was 13, had me a boyfriend till I kissed him. Poor boy went into a coma for 3 days. It got so if I touched anybody, it just drove the life right out of him. Oh, I don't know, Beast. You know everything. What makes us like the way we are anyway? And that was amazing, the little spiel.
Yeah.
And then I was screaming on the headphones in Los Angeles, mm-hmm, on the other end. And I found out later it was Larry Houston and all the producers. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, don't let her leave the building. That's her. That's Rogue. That's the one where we've been looking for. And the rest is history.
It is not just history, but also future, because now X-Men 97 is back, right? So
Days of Future Past.
There you go. So what is it like coming back to Rogue after all these years? I know you've done some video game work there after the show finished, but generally you haven't really like hung out with Rogue or been Rogue for a number of years. So
yep.
What were you looking forward to when you got back to being Rogue? Was it the sassiness or flirting with Gambit, or was there any particular aspect of Rogue that you were looking forward to?
All of the above. I mean, what's not to love about Rogue? She is such a cool cat, right? To be honest, I was a little nervous when I first went in the booth. It was my birthday, interestingly enough. It was November 22nd, which is my birthday. when I recorded my first episode of X-Men 97. And I just had a little bit of flutter of trepidation of, oh my God, is she still there? You know, are they going to like what I do? And I just opened up my mouth. I put the headphones on. I opened up my mouth and I just did the first line. And within seconds of doing the line, of being in that line, I realized she was there. She'd always been there. She had never left me. Mm-hmm. And so I like to think of her as, it's like putting on a pair of fine, well-worn gloves that are very comfortable. Mm. Slip them on and she's back.
It sounds too like a friendship where you don't see a person that often or that regularly, right? But when you run into them, you just pick up exactly where you left off.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And seeing the rest of the team is like that as well. You know, when we get together, when we got together for the premiere in L.A. and the premiere in Toronto, and any of the Comic-Cons where we get to be a team together, it's so nice just to be back with the family. Mm-hmm. You know, and our X-Men community has been growing and growing and growing, and I feel like we are a family. So I oftentimes call us the X-Men familia, you know. Family, like we're all inclusive. Everybody is welcome. And it's just it's a warm feeling to know that you belong to a group of caring, kind, considerate, and compassionate, progressive individuals.
Even for the fans now, this must be generational, right?
Because yes.
It's been a while since the show was originally on, and it's been floating around on like TV, Disney Plus, like, yeah. So you must be getting, like, I'm sure at Toronto Comic Con, for example, you must have gotten generations of people who saw it when they were kids, and now they have kids of their own who are watching it.
Exactly. Yeah, we actually sometimes get three generations.
Wow.
The grandparents had children who they turned on to X-Men, and those parents have children. And so they're all so thrilled that we're now going to be doing new episodes, and they tell us that they're going to watch it together, which is so nice. And, you know, I have to harken back to when I was a kid growing up first in Australia before I moved to Canada. I moved to Canada at the age of 8, but my mom and dad and I used to watch The Wonderful World of Disney on the weekends together on our little black and white television. And we loved that show. That was our favorite show. It was my favorite show. And I always wanted to get to Disneyland. And when I was 8, we moved to Canada, but we did it. We sailed over on a ship, the SS Canberra. And we sailed first to San Francisco and then Los Angeles. And we got off in Los Angeles. Mom and Dad took me to Disneyland. And then we drove from there, we rented a car, drove from there all the way to Las Vegas, and our car broke down on the main strip of Las Vegas. So then we had to get a Greyhound bus the rest of the way to Regina, Saskatchewan, which
from
is where
Vegas?
My dad. Yeah, from Vegas.
To Regina? Oh, man, how long did that take? Like a month or something?
I can't remember. Yeah, I don't remember.
That's a crazy journey.
And that's how we landed in Canada on Greyhound bus. So on my papers that show, you know, when I first came to Canada, it says, how did you arrive? Greyhound bus.
That must have been like I've been to Regina. I've never been to Australia. I would assume that Regina is in many ways the opposite of Australia.
Lots of snow.
Yeah, right.
And very flat. So yeah, we were there for about a year. That was our first year in Canada. We saw snow for the first time. But, you know, I had this thick Australian accent, and the kids had trouble understanding me, and they'd say, well, what language do you speak in Australia? No?
Yeah.
And I mean, English, right? But with a strong accent. Mm-hmm. But so we stayed there for a year, and then they heard how beautiful Nova Scotia was. And so mom and dad wanted to see Canada. And so then we actually camped. We had a camper trailer we got, and we camped all the way across Canada to Truro, Nova Scotia, where dad then had a job at the Nova Scotia Teachers College and mom had a job at the junior high school, Truro Junior High School. And then we fell in love with Nova Scotia and we never left. So that's why I grew up in Nova Scotia after that. But like I said, I became an actor, a professional at 17, and I was off doing work around the country and in the States. Mm-hmm. By the time I was 18 or 19.
This might be cheap psychology, but doesn't that kind of restlessness and like moving around and getting on Greyhound buses and all that kind of, like, does that kind of contribute a little bit to some of the loneliness that Rogue felt? Because you would always, I would always assume that you would be an outsider a little bit of everywhere you went.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, people say, oh, well, you don't have an Australian accent. And I'm like, yeah, that's because the kids made fun of it in school. Mm-hmm. They make fun of it.
You were the mutant.
I was the mutant. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had to always try and fit in, mm-hmm. you know, wherever I went. Even when we moved to Nova Scotia, to Truro, we moved 4 times during that time period when we were there. So I went to all different schools, met all the new kids, and was constantly kind of trying to reinvent myself to fit into whatever situation I found. And so I think that that definitely had an impact on my portrayal of Rogue and understanding her loneliness and how she just wants to be normal like everybody else and she just wants to fit in. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people can relate to that in that character. And that's why they also love her, because she reminds them of them.
Yeah, but also Rogue in the cartoon, in the original series, like, she came to, I guess, peace with who she is, right? The classic line was, there's no cure for who you are. I can't do the voice. But
exactly. In The Cure, the episode The Cure, mm-hmm. when she goes to your island because she wants to have her mutant powers removed by this genetic scientist who has claimed that he can do it. Obviously, she finds out that he actually wants to harness her powers, and Mystique wants to harness her powers and use her for ill purposes. But in the end of that episode, she has what I would call a spiritual awakening when she realizes that it's her superpowers that are so unique that actually make her who she is. And while they bring her pain, because she, you know, if she touches anybody skin to skin, she can drain them of all their life force and therefore become stronger herself. That means she also can never be intimate with anybody. And therefore, she can never, you know, have a love partner and a family. And that makes her feel extremely lonely. Mm-hmm. But in the end, as we said, she comes to the realization that these powers are what make her who she is. So she has to learn to embrace them and embrace herself and accept herself for who she is. And at the very end of the episode, she says, well, you know, I realize that my powers are me and I can use them for good. And I reckon I can live with that. So there ain't no cure for who you are. And I love that. I think that's a very powerful message for many, many people who are struggling with their own identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a core message of the X-Men, which is like what Professor X set up. I know these are not real people, but you know what I mean? Like, he basically had a dream. He was like the mutant MLK. And his message was, you know, he wanted people to go on the same journey that Rogue went on, which is like, look, you're weird, or you have lasers that come out of your eyes, or whatever it may be. You're covered in blue fur, but you will eventually come to a peace and understanding of who you are and acceptance of who you are. And eventually you hope that other people will accept you for who you are.
Right, exactly. And the newer characters that are now come to Professor X's Academy for Gifted Mutants with the same thing. They don't, you know, they don't know how to accept or love themselves. They don't feel comfortable in their own skin. And to be honest, you know, another factor of how I can relate to Rogue was I quit drinking 28 years ago during the last season of X-Men the first time around. Like, I quit drinking before we started recording that season.
Congratulations. And that's amazing.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'll be celebrating 28 years this April 12th. And, you know, I realized I was drinking because I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. Mm-hmm. I used it as self-medication to try to make me feel like I was okay, instead of just going, you know what, there's a beautiful person inside of you and a powerful being. You just got to learn to accept that person and that powerful being and give them some self-love and encouragement. And embrace who you are. So I had to go through the same thing. And I think a lot of people also will use substances or behaviors that aren't healthy for them because they just don't feel comfortable in their own skin and they're not able to accept themselves for who they are. So, you know, my message again is, yeah, you need to fill that empty void inside of you with some self-love and acceptance, because filling that empty void inside of you with outside things is not going to work. It might for a little while, and you might fool yourself that it's working for a little while, but eventually it will come back to bite you.
Which is an odd segue for us to talk about politics, because with politics, you have to confront the current realities. You have to make things better. You have to address situations. You know what I mean? You can't just delay them or hope things get better or whatever, ignore them.
Right.
Want to pick up, just touch upon your political career, because I find this fascinating. Mm-hmm. When you were at York University, you studied drama, and we've already mm-hmm. covered that with your theater work, with your X-Men work, movie work. But what sparked your interest in politics?
Well, I took poli-sci as well in university, because I had two great interests, and one was the arts, performing, and one was politics. Around the kitchen table, when I was a kid, my grandmother and grandfather oftentimes talked about politics. My mom and dad talked about politics. And so at a very early age, I was aware of what politics were and how unfair things were for some people, how civil rights were so important to fight for, social justice, standing up for the underdog, for people who didn't have as much power, maybe they didn't have as much money or power, racialized communities, women's rights were a big issue. And so I was imbued with that at an early age. And, you know, for years I was an activist, and I would do things as an actor that would, you know, I go to rallies and help support world peace and anti-nuclear organizations and environmental organizations and women's rights and LGBTQ rights, things like that. But when I went into politics, I realized this was an avenue that I could use all those passions and really try to make a difference in the world, and try to bring more people an awareness of how other people were faring. Because sometimes we live in our own little pockets of humanity. We don't really realize what's going on over there. And this is, of course, before the Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. happened. It was important to me to address issues on a larger scale. And when I was asked to run for politics, I just thought, well, what have I got to lose, you know? I looked at it like it was a big audition. I'll either get it or I won't. My dad gave me all the encouragement in the world and said, yeah, go ahead. Like, go. Like, why not? And I won, you know, in a landslide. And they called it a zanslide. I won with so many.
Yeah.
So that's cool. I ended up in politics for 12 years, 4 terms. Mm-hmm. Terms as a provincial legislator, as a MLA, member of the Legislative Assembly in the Nova Scotia House of Assembly. And then my final term was as a federal MP with Prime Minister Trudeau. And that was, again, very exciting and very challenging.
This is maybe a bit of a complex question, but like you said, so you're a member of parliament. Does being in government affect change or the status quo, or does making something like X-Men affect the change? Like, what have you found has made the positive changes? Like, is it working within the political system, or is it like doing something with the arts, for example, a play, a movie, an X-Men cartoon? Like, how do you find like we impact and change?
Right. I say both. You have to do it from within and from without. So you need people on the inside who are progressive, compassionate, caring, want to make a difference, want to change the world so that people are all respected, that there is tolerance and, you know, that equal rights for everybody. But you also need people outside who are the foot soldiers, who are willing to knock on doors during elections, donate to the candidate of their choice, help that candidate become elected, because those elected officials are going to make a huge difference in your life, either for the good or for the bad. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is look south of the border and see what's going on with the United States to see how and even in Canada, really, to see how some very right-wing politicians are enacting terrible laws that are anti-LGBTQ, that are make it harder for women to have reproductive rights, to be in charge of their own bodies. And, you know, so it's very, very important that we have people in government that actually get the right picture and are willing to work towards creating a more kind, compassionate, and tolerant world. Also, to try and lift people up out of poverty, because poverty is what also breeds a lot of the problems. So if you've got a society where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, trust me, there are going to be problems. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a system and a society where most people are looked after and there's no poverty or only a little bit of poverty, which you need to keep trying to alleviate and get rid of, eradicate, those societies, even the rich people do better and have longer lifespans than in societies where there's a huge gap between the rich and the poor. So doing shows like X-Men and others, even Rescue Heroes, when I did Rescue Heroes for kids, it was great because it taught kids lessons in how to protect themselves in emergency situations. You know, if there was a flood or a fire or an avalanche or whatever. And so I think you have to do it both. And I feel really pretty lucky that I've been able to have a go at both. I have a bill right now that is passing through the Senate, mm-hmm. in Canada's parliament, and it's called A National Strategy to Address Environmental Racism and Environmental Justice. And I introduced that bill first in Nova Scotia in the legislature back in 2014. And then when I went federal, I introduced it in 2020 in the Canada's parliament. And it almost made it through the House, but then there was a split. There was a quick election that was called. So I lost my seat, that fifth election. I lost my seat and the bill went off the table. But friends of mine in the House, in the House of Commons, reached out and said, "Hey, Lenore, is it okay if we reintroduce your bill and make sure that we will say this came from Lenore?" I said, "You know, yeah, absolutely. Let me make sure that I'll talk to the Prime Minister and the Minister of Environment to make sure it gets the support of government." So I flew to Ottawa and I had a meeting with the Prime Minister and a meeting with Minister Gilbeault of the Environment. And they both said, "Absolutely, we're 100% behind your bill, Lenore, and we will help to make sure it gets passed." So right now, it has gone through the House of Commons already. It's passed that. Now it's in the Senate. It's going to the Environment Committee in the Senate March 21st. And then it will go back to the House if it passes there, which I think it will. Go back to the Senate again for third and final reading. And if it passes that, it will become law in Canada.
And what exactly does the bill do, or what is it look out for?
Right. So environmental racism is the disproportionate number of toxic waste sites, dumps, landfills, and corporate polluters that are placed on or beside racialized communities. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the history of Canada, even America, most countries, they have placed those kinds of polluting regions right beside a racialized community because they didn't want to put it by the white community. Mm-hmm. And that means that those racialized communities have different health outcomes and have higher rates of cancer and reproductive problems and things like this, breathing problems, because they live right beside a toxic dump or whatever. So this bill is designed to be able to collect data to see where they exist across Canada and make referrals to government as to what should be done and how these people can be make sure that it doesn't continue to happen.
Yeah, that's cool. So we've touched upon like X-Men and Rogue. We've touched upon Happy Birthday to Me, your theater work, your political work. Are all these life lessons, are they going to end up in your memoir?
Yes, they are. Yeah, And I can't fit everything into my memoir. I'm taking this memoir up from my birth in Australia and then moving over to Canada and doing acting in the States and back and forth and around the world, and X-Men the first time around, and going right up until 1996 when I quit drinking. And I also did I was able to be alive to do the fifth season of X-Men. And then a sort of a recap of what I've done since then. But at this point, I think that'll be a good chunk for people, probably about 200 pages, 225 pages. It's called A Rogue's Tale, and it will
Clever, yeah.
And it'll be out next fall. It'll be available. Potter's Field Press is publishing it with Nimbus Publishing distributing it, and it will be available also on Amazon. And if the book goes well and people really love it, then I'll write a second one and pick up where I left off from 1997 and mm-hmm. talk about political years and all the things that happened in there and coming back and X-Men 97 being a superhero again.
Yeah. And as we're wrapping up, I've seen the first three episodes of the new series, and Rogue is back to her like phrases again, her classic phrases.
She is. Yeah. What's up?
The one I like is she talks to Magneto and she says to him, like, well, your little pep talk went about as smooth as a dozen cats in a yarn store.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Do you ever end up picking up any of those phrases or like using them in life, or like do you ever find them just kind of coming out, or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of my favorites from the old show keeps coming up which is, you know, you look about as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. Yeah. That comes out quite a bit.
It seems like now with like Dolly Parton's popularity, there's a little bit of Dolly Parton in your Rogue, is there, or is that like?
I think that's just a coincidence because maybe she, you know, her sassiness and her brashness and her sense of humor is similar to Rogue's, but I didn't do it consciously. It's just really Rogue is just, it's me utilizing all of my own angst and my own passions and my own voice with a little Southern accent thrown in for good measure, sugar.
There we go. That's perfect. That's where we got to end it. That's a positive note. Thank you, Lenore, so much for like hanging out. It was great. I didn't get the chance to talk to you personally at Toronto Comic Con, but I saw you and I was there at the Xavier's Lounge.
Yeah, I thought I saw you too. Yeah.
Yo, that was Lenore, the voice of Rogue in X-Men 97, and I'm Sammy, host of My Summer Lair. Your cruelty has only made humanity more sympathetic to our cause. This is what Storm says to the villain, Henry Peter Gyrick, in the first episode of X-Men 97. Your cruelty has only made humanity more sympathetic to our cause. X-Men 97 is now streaming on Disney+. Indeed, Marvel's Mighty Mutants are back, and they're still, to the multitudes, monsters. One of the distinct aspects of X-Men 97 is blood. In an episode of the revival, Cyclops is attacked and he bleeds from his mouth. I think Batman the Animated Series was the only other notable comic book cartoon blood I've seen. And that's a bloody good sign. Back when the first episode of X-Men Animated Series aired, they quickly killed Morph to establish a more adult tone for the series. Sure, it's a cartoon, but like comics, comics are not always for kids. Another notable to note about the X-Men animated series is that it set up the Marvel movies. In the early 90s, Hollywood studios didn't believe live-action superheroes would make box office bank. I know, right? So Marvel, unable to sell studios on their characters, which include Iron Man and Captain America and a number of others, decide to make a cartoon instead. The popularity of the X-Men cartoon, especially a cartoon with connected stories like the Marvel movies that would eventually follow them, proved there was a non-nerd market for superheroes. X-Men, the movie opened on July 14, 2000. That was 3 years after the animated series wrapped. Spider-Man followed X-Men on May 3rd, 2002. And we're off! Eventually, Iron Man showed up in 2008, and you know the rest. But these Days of the Future Past started with the X-Men animated series in 1992, with characters like Rogue, voiced by Lenore Zann. Nothing comes out of a void. That's why I write My Pal Sammy a Substack newsletter. Pop culture is like a road trip, and I want to know how we got here, and I want to understand where we're going. The future is as thrilling as the past. It's 2024, we're watching a TV show called X-Men 97. The future is as thrilling as is the past. So sign up today and improve your future. MySummerLayer.com/subscribe or Google My Pal Sammy Substack. I don't think you even need to put the Substack. I think if you just Google My Pal Sammy, bam, number one. And please sign up as soon as you hear this because, look, let's be honest here. I'm not the only one with the mutant ability to nap. Napping is infectious. Thank you so much for listening to me in a Netflix world. Rogue, yo.